Welcome to the Jonathan Edwards Podcast, a podcast brought to you by the Jonathan Edwards Center at Gateway Seminary. My name is Chris Wozdicki, and I have the privilege of being the research fellow here at the Jonathan Edwards Center, or as we like to call it around here, the JEC. For those of you who are not familiar with the JEC, it's one of 10 international affiliate centers of the Jonathan Edwards Center at Yale University. Here at Gateway, we strive to be the premier educational epicenter for researching the life and works of America's premier theologian out on the West Coast. I think we pride ourselves on the West Coast part quite a bit. How do we do that? Well, we do that by strengthening our doctoral programs, networking with international scholarly communities and churches, and finally by hosting this podcast as well. In these episodes, we get to talk to premier Jonathan Edwards scholars about cutting-edge research. We also get to take an opportunity to dive into some of Edwards' most famous works. And most importantly, we get to talk about why any of this actually matters for the church. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce to you today's guest, Zach Tharp. Welcome, Zach.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
Absolutely. So, Zach, tell us a little bit about who you are and the institution you're affiliated with.
Yeah, so I've been studying Edwards for a couple of years. I'm currently a PhD candidate at Ridley, Melbourne, through the Australian College of Theology. And then my day job is that I teach high school English in Texas.
Very cool. Yeah, that's funny. I also tutor at Ridley, and I taught high school Bible for a year. That was a 10th grader specifically, so that was a fun experience. Now, one of the things that this podcast hopes to do is to introduce people to Edwardsian scholarship. So there's a whole range of people in this audience, some people who are already in the thick of things, some people who are starting to think about how they might want to get interested or dive into this field. And you're in a unique position. You know, you're currently a PhD candidate studying Edwards. So I'm just wondering, at what point in the process of your theological education did you get pulled into studying Edwards in a more academic way? And why do a PhD on him?
Yeah, good question. So I did an undergraduate thesis at a state university in Texas, Stephen F. Austin. I had a friend and mentor who coached me through the end for which God created the world. And that was kind of getting my feet wet, kind of diving headfirst into Edwardian studies. But then kind of had my eyes set when I went and did master's work at Southern Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, on Edwards and his context. I was just kind of fascinated with him as a person and as a Bible reader. I was noticing that not a lot of folks were working on those kinds of things. So under Michael Haken, if you know who that is, I think many of us Baptists know Michael Haken and his historical work pretty well. Yep. I studied with him, a colonial pastor that's in kind of the background of Edwards' world, named Edward Taylor. Edward Taylor kind of goes toe-to-toe with Solomon Stoddard over the Lord's Supper. A generation before Edwards, just to kind of get introduced to Edwards' milieu and kind of what his world would have been like, the theological world that he would have inherited. And then that really set the table for me to start doing doctoral work at Ridley.
And remind me who you're studying with at Ridley, who you're doing your PhD under?
Yes. Yeah, so the Dean of Missional Leadership, Reese Besant, at Ridley Melbourne. He's published a couple of books on Edwards in some unique areas. So Edwards as ecclesiology and Edwards as a mentor. It's been a real joy to work with him there.
Yeah. And he also heads up the Jonathan Edwards Center down there.
He does. Yeah. The Jonathan Edwards Center Australia, which a couple of years ago hosted its own Congress back in 2015. That center has a couple of ongoing projects that have to do with Edwards and his parish ministry, as well as Edwards and his exegesis.
Very cool. You know, one of the things that are interesting about the different centers is that they all tend to have a specific focus. They're not all doing the same thing. And here at the Gateway Center, we focus obviously just broadly on Edwards, but also his relationship to Baptists and the Baptist tradition. Mm-hmm. So some of our listeners might be wondering what advice you might have to give to PhD students, because some of them might be considering doing a PhD on Edwards here at Gateway. Others might be considering doing it somewhere else. But what advice would you, as a PhD student who's a little bit further down the line than somebody who's just considering it, would you give to students trying to study Edwards, or maybe even just doing a PhD in general?
Yeah, well, I'm certainly no expert in doing a PhD in general because of I'm part-time, not full-time. That there are wiser sages among us on doing it full time, no doubt. But in terms of Edwards specifically, I think it's a great question. Knowing that the Edwards centers around the world, which are doing great research on kind of America's premier theologian, right? The different emphases, really kind of figuring out where those are at early on would certainly help someone who's kind of thinking about, like, I appreciate Edwards's theological constructions, or I appreciate, you know, this part of his kind of narrative or biographical narrative, if you will. So knowing that, like, for example, the JEC in Heidelberg has put out some great historiographical work. They've got an interesting project on Cotton Mather, who's kind of a figure who's adjacent to Edwards. Cotton Mather produces like the first Bible commentary on American soil. So that's kind of interesting and related to some other areas of study in Edwards. The Jonathan Edwards Center in Australia has a real pastoral bent to it, even though we're looking at Edwards critically and his manuscripts critically, there's still a lot of application, I would say. We kind of share that same sentiment that you guys on the West Coast have of just an appreciation of Edwards, not just as a philosopher, but Edwards as pastor, and what did he do day to day, and how was he handling the biblical text in his specific context, you know?
Yeah, so you said you're doing it part-time. I think that's going to be an increasing reality just with the way that funding is just across academia in general, not even within seminary context. Could you speak a little bit about how you've approached having a full-time job and then also being a student and being expected to write, do research and write?
Yeah, it's definitely shifting. I think all of Christian higher ed, I think a lot, everybody I talk to would attest to the way that the landscape's kind of changing and in flux. It is a bit taxing, I'll say, but even if you have occupations in other areas, I think that there's ways that we can make these kind of high shelf theological ideas a little more invading the space of our everyday life. I mean, I think that's kind of Edwardsian too, right? You notice that with Edwards, there's often the caricature that, you know, he spent 12 hours a day or 14 hours a day. There's people will say different things in his study, but what that neglects to see is the way in which he interacted with real people, and that they would come and visit his study and chat with him or ask him particular questions. And the way I've seen that play out in my particular area of work before I was a TA at Southern Seminary, and then now I teach high school full time. And the way that I see that play out is sometimes I'll have my students read like the letter to Deborah Hathaway, which is a notable work of Christian piety that Edwards pens, or I'll have them probably read one too many Great Awakening letters and have them work on it. And then that also lets me kind of continue to soak in those research areas as well. So there's ways that you can kind of bend what you do. Well, and there's
There's the school bell. So yeah, so what I'm hearing is integration is really important. So I came across your paper while looking at the schedule for the Global Jonathan Edwards Center Conference, which happened in July of this year, 2023. You got to present a paper that I thought was interesting. It was one of the ones that just caught my eye because it was a topic that I hadn't really seen addressed. Before we talk about the actual paper, can you tell us a little bit about what these congresses are like? Is it just like a regular academic conference? Like what's, I mean, it's global, so it's not like ETS, you know? Tell us a little bit about the Congress.
Yeah, so one thing that I've really appreciated, I started the PhD journey in 2019. One thing I've really appreciated about the Jonathan Edwards Centers is just kind of the congeniality between them. It's really interesting to see just how ecumenical that they can be. Part of that is kind of necessary, I suppose, but at another level, there's just some great conversation and some real Edwardsian warmth between them, which is really nice. It's not the kind of dry, erudite, just papers that one might expect. But the Jonathan Edwards Congress, this one in particular, was hosted by the JEC Benelux, which is housed in the Evangelical Theology faculty there in Leuven in Belgium. And so a lot of the scholars, both junior and senior scholars, would have some meals together and some times to informally discuss some hot topics in Edwards studies right now, which is just a lot of fun, as well as like the main stage speaker. So I attended the one at Yale a couple of years ago as well with some with no small names like Skip Stout and George Marsden presenting the kind of plenaries there. But this one in Belgium centered on spirituality and rationality. And so my paper fit a bit more under spirituality, but trying to look at Edwards and his view of laughter.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a really interesting topic. So laughter among pastors and preachers is somewhat of a hot topic. Like I can think of a whole spectrum of how pastors either use or don't use humor in sermons. Like on the one hand, you have people who think it's like absolutely detestable, like never do it. And then there's others who you'd think that they think that they're stand-up comedians the way they use it. Is this dichotomy kind of what got you into examining Edwards on humor, or was it something else?
It was something else. So I have a friend named Greg Trickett, who is a philosopher and was a friend of someone who did some work in analytic theology. So that there's a little bit of crossover there. But he hosted our local conference, which initially kind of piqued my interest for this particular area of Edwards' life. So he hosted a local conference here in Weatherford, Texas, at the community college, and it was a conference on kind of philosophy and laughter, or philosophy and humor. And so that I began to ask questions about, well, what did Edwards actually think about laughter, and was he consistent over his whole life on laughter? And that led me to his resolution on laughter, which evolved into the whole paper.
Just follow that that rabbit trail. So your paper, it was titled "With an Airness of Lightness and Humor, Jonathan Edwards on Humor." In it, you note that Edwards does some interesting exegetical work on laughter. So my question is, how does laughter fit into his historical redemptive exegesis?
Yeah, and so this particular paper I was writing kind of chasing down this idea, and it ties indirectly to my overall project, my overall dissertation. I'm looking at kind of Edwards' sermons on John and what's governing his exegesis of the fourth gospel. But particularly, I've had an eye towards exegesis, but I began to notice that there was this kind of dichotomy between the way in which Edwards conceives of laughter in his own spiritual walk and as he advises people, and then what he is drawing from the biblical data and the way that laughter usually tracks pretty negatively. So he will, in his Notes on Scripture, which is a really early text or manuscript that Edwards creates, he looks at Genesis, and he's looking at a particular portion of Genesis that he's going to interpret the name of Isaac kind of typologically, and he's going to, in that entry, say some surprising things about laughter. There's other portions of his corpus where he'll use the wisdom literature to speak of laughter. So in part, when it comes to Edwards kind of as an exegete, which is often kind of forgotten in scholarship, right? Edwards is getting categories for laughter from the biblical text itself, but particularly on the note that he enters there on Genesis 18, he goes on and on, as he does often in these entries, kind of parsing out the meaning of Isaac's name. And then he begins to see just kind of this tracing of all of redemption history connected in the way that Isaac prefigures Christ. So especially as with the biblical material, I kind of mentioned that it tracks kind of negatively, right? Most of the time it leads Edwards to thinking about the foolishness and the way in which fools laugh. He's pulling that from the wisdom literature. But elsewhere, he also will point that out. So in Genesis 18, he talks about how Isaac, whose name means laughter, was conceived about the same time that Sodom is destroyed. And so he takes that kind of as a key, that the destruction of people that are contra God, they're often filled with laughter. And he even pulls that explicitly from Psalm 126:1. But he traces it through the way that God's enemies have been destroyed there in Genesis, and the way that the ancient Egyptians are destroyed at the Red Sea. And then he traces it through Babylon, and then even beyond the biblical data in the Roman Empire and into the days of Constantine. So he's got some places that modern Bible interpreters probably would not go with Isaac's name. But overall, laughter features, especially in that note, as an association with those that are outside of God. He associates the wicked are filled with laughter, the enemies of God are filled with laughter. And ultimately, he's going to apply that to the Antichrist.
Maybe the answer is no, because that's not the focus of your paper or the research. But do you know if there's any sort of like contemporary biblical theology of laughter, if anybody's written like an article or like a monograph on it? Because it seems like a thread that would be interesting to just follow throughout scripture.
It's all over the place. It is. It's one of those things that it's similar to maybe like trees. And other kind of images that are used again and again in scripture, especially when you think about some texts that get really applicable quite quickly, like the Proverbs or the Psalter. I don't know of any biblical theological texts that talk about it, but I surely would be interested to read one.
Yeah, somebody needs to write it up. So he looks at laughter from an exegetical perspective. But laughter also plays an interesting role in Edwards' experience of the Great Awakening. You know, there's stories of people just bursting into laughter during some of these meetings. He wrote to some converts about laughter. Can you shed a little bit of light on the complicated place of laughter in Edwards' understanding of revivals, and maybe why someone would even think that it's complicated?
Yeah, so Edwards uses laughter all over his corpus, but many, especially students of the Great Awakening or the Evangelical Revival, would be right to kind of jump to where this has a place in the kind of extremities of the revivals. Edwards uses laughter 98 times overall in his corpus, and they're spread out. Sometimes they key towards texts, and you can search these on your own. Any student that wants to can look these up with the works of Jonathan Edwards online and the search function there that's provided by Yale. But Ecclesiastes 2:2 comes up a couple of times. Proverbs 14:13 comes up. Ecclesiastes 7:6. But then in Edwards' experience, it's not as though he's like addressing a particular outburst, quoting chapter and verse, right? Instead, usually what he's seeing is amidst all of the extreme parts of the revivals, a lot of times this expressive emotion means for Edwards a mark of true joy. So part of what he'll talk about in A Faithful Narrative, which is an earlier one, which he kind of addresses some of the ways in which he might have overspoke later on. But when he's recounting what kind of becomes a paradigmatic account or a revival, he'll say that of those that are experiencing a work of God, their joyful surprise has caught their hearts as it was to leap, so that they've been ready to break forth into laughter, tears often at the same time issuing like a flood and intermingling a wild, loud weeping. So there's this this crying out to God, and then he's going to go on to talk about that they've come in view of the glory of God's sovereignty and the exercises of his grace, which is just a really profound juxtaposition, right? We don't tend to think about religious experience in quite the same way, even as evangelicals today. We don't always address your profound laughter is because you're experiencing God's glory. But for Edwards in his particular milieu, as the revivals begin to take off in the 1730s and then really burst on the scene in the 1740s, laughter tracks for him in a way that really usually kind of connotes joy. That's what I see in his writings on the revival. Most of the time, they're conveying the kind of it might be a false sign, but it could in fact confirm the conversions that are happening, some that are quite surprising.
Yeah, that's great. So there's the exegetical piece, the revival piece. There's also a little bit on Edwards' personal and personality when it comes to laughter. You know, there was this interesting quote. It was a really interesting quote by his daughter where I'll just read part of it. So she says, you all sit in the middle room. Father, Jonathan Edwards, father has a talk and Mr. Burr has a laugh. Mr. Prince gets room to stick in a word once in a while. The rest of you sit and see and hear and make observations to yourself. And she kind of goes on to describe this situation, which, I mean, a lot of people probably wouldn't think of Edwards talking and somebody laughing in response. As you've been doing research on Edwards, maybe even just for this project, what are some of the stereotypes that you found were sort of dispelled? Because there's a very stereotypical picture of Edwards and the way that he preaches. How are some of those stereotypes dispelled by your study?
Yeah, and that was really what was fun about this paper, was asking the question. So early in his life, right, Edwards writes a set of resolutions, one of which is that he's never going to laugh on the Lord's Day. That was kind of the crux of the question that started this paper for me. Was I was trying to see Edwards not just as the theologian with a bunch of ideas, kind of a stick figure in the past that is just, it's almost Gnostic, right? Just these ideas floating around in the past, but trying to see him as somebody who grew over time and changed, and even in certain ways hardens, right? As he's dealing with a lot of criticism for his defense of certain ministers in the Great Awakening, opposed certainly by certain factions, and then really at the end of the 1750s is fired by his church. You see Edwards change and morph over time. So I'm trying to figure out why did he think that he needed to have a resolution? And I don't have a great answer to that, to be honest, Chris. Why did he think that he didn't need to laugh on the Lord's Day? Was it something in his personality? That's where I would tend to go, is that I think something in his personality would be given to, maybe he saw himself as too unserious, and so he needed to resolve, no, on the Lord's Day, I'm going to be serious. I'm going to be about diligent study and diligent preaching, as he pens that in kind of the New York period or his first short pastorate, which is about 8 months. But Edwards goes on in his life to certainly have company with people, particularly one of his daughters that he's certainly close to, particularly his eventual son-in-law that he hosts. And we have this great line from the diary. So you also have that kind of lens from someone who's an exemplar of female piety in the period, which is that's not that common, right, given what's out there. But Esther Edwards Burr says that, and I really wish I could find something that said Edwards laughed. But I was not able to find a moment later on in his life. So maybe there's a nugget of truth in the kind of caricature that's out there. But clearly, Edwards's true social dynamic is complex because he hosts people that certainly like to have a lighthearted time, and that's seen in a positive light through the eyes of his own daughter. And eventual son-in-law as well. So as he hosts the eventual president of Princeton and his daughter who marries Aaron Burr Sr., the Presbyterian minister and president of Princeton, he is noted for talking and communicating. And you get this kind of exuberant, joyful communication that's kind of threaded subtly throughout Edwards's life. But the fact that he would host someone that he was allowing his daughter to court and then marry says something at one level. But even more than that, we can see from the kind of diversity of personalities. I think of the juxtaposition between perhaps Bellamy, who he certainly lets into his life, and then Samuel Hopkins, who he lets into his life as well. They're very different temperamentally if you read them or look at secondary literature on those two mentees of Edwards. And so it's interesting to me that this kind of caricature of a hellfire and brimstone preacher, somebody who, you know, always talked about sinners hanging over the fire on a line of a spider's thread. That's really not the real Edwards, because in his corpus, he talks more about heaven than he does hell. He talks about angels all the time. His daily exercise is going to the woods and making notes about things that he's going to write on later. Just quite obsessed with the biblical text, but then his daily life looks a whole like normal pastors do today of counseling people that come into his office and preparing sermonic material and preaching them in pretty normative ways of for his day, opening the text and then preaching the doctrine and then preaching applications or uses. There is a very normal side to Edwards that pairs well with his brilliance, to say the least.
Yeah, and I don't want to read too much into the quote because it doesn't give us a ton of details, but it's hard to imagine. You think about people today, people who have sort of like a dour or like curmudgeon-y sort of attitude, mm-hmm. like they kind of suck the fun out of a room, you know? Other people can't really have that much fun around them. But it seems like in this situation that she's describing, that it seems like a pretty enjoyable time. So I would say, yeah, that's an interesting picture that she paints. So you mentioned this resolution, and I'll read it. So he says specifically Resolution 38, never to speak anything that is ridiculous or matter of laughter on the Lord's day. As you come to like the end of this study, do you think the adult Edwards would agree with the young Edwards on this resolution? If so, what makes you think that? And if not, why?
Yeah, great question. Frustratingly, I could not find a well-attested to biographical note that Edwards did laugh, right? And that is frustrating. If someone watches this podcast and knows of something, they should email us for sure. I think in terms of the way that Edwards changed, I think that's a really good question. For the longest time, And we're sometimes guilty of this in historical theology, right? We say this person's view was this, Barth thought this about scripture, or Martin Luther thought this about grace, right? And that sometimes can be a little reductionistic, right? Edwards over time certainly changes because he's a man in a fallen world. I think looking at some of the work that's going on in like theological anthropology these days, and the good work that's being done in that particular area, might revise some of our depictions of particular historical theologians and figures and preachers and whatnot. But in terms of did Edwards change on this? I don't have any. He's far too reverent on the Lord's Day and the office of pastor and the place of preaching, especially in the Great Awakenings. I don't see him as moving away from this resolution, although he may have broke it on occasion. He might have been quite convicted given the way that he resolves to do a lot of other things. I mean, he's certainly extraordinarily, almost superhumanly self-disciplined, and we have pretty good attestation to that in the biographical material. But in terms of Edwards's change in his rhetoric or what he would have thought, of course, that's going to change. I think Michael Keller has demonstrated that really well with the stylometrical dissertation that he produced on Edwards's sermons. His most extreme language increases later in his life. That's what Michael Keller pretty clearly shows. So when Edwards is later in his life, I think we have a pretty nuanced picture of laughter, as well as the other things that Edwards would have talked about. The degree of that change is the project of historians, I guess. You know, like that's what we're trying to measure is over time, does this person change in particular helpful ways? My base assumption in this paper, though, was to see were there any good indications of this. The common depiction of a kind of demure, soft-spoken intellectual type. Did Edwards really fit that bill, or was it more complex? And I tend to think that he certainly had a deep personality, right? I don't think that he was nearly as congenial as maybe a George Whitfield of his time, to contrast someone who's contemporary or someone later like Charles Spurgeon, who certainly got a social acumen that maybe Edwards lacks at a level. But I would land, when you examine Edwards's life, though in his home, he's got a place for spiritual counsel. He's got clearly a high esteem for his wife and his children. It really cuts against that kind of picture of an antisocial, you know, German theologian that's just dropped in the American or the British North American colonial wilderness, locked up in his mansion. Like, that's not the real Edwards, right? Probably he might have been given over to a ton of laughter, from my best guess on what I've looked at. But clearly through the eyes of people close to him, he invited folks that enjoyed to chat a lot and enjoyed lightheartedness in their time.
Yeah, you know, it would be interesting to go back and read through some of his sermons and see if any, I guess, lighthearted or humorous content can be found in them. You know, humor is such a contextual thing where, like, mm-hmm. somebody can read something and not find it funny at all 200 years later, where it might be maybe not even humorous, but lighthearted. You know, you think of reading in the Gospels, like, there's certain things that I would believe right. that Jesus says that seem kind of funny to their audience, but, like, those jokes don't land on us, you know, about right. like camels going through needles, eye of needles and stuff. Like, that's a pretty ridiculous image that, like, I don't think people hear it today and are, like, bursting out laughing, but maybe yeah. somebody back then would have, you know, or like a sower, like, throwing seeds onto, like, a hard path. It's like, well, that's ridiculous. Who would ever do that? I wonder if there's anything like that in Edwards.
I would imagine you'd be hard pressed to find something just overtly funny in the sermons. And since, I mean, I've looked at every John sermon of Edwards, and they are not funny. They treat the subject with a lot of reverence and appropriate pastoral zeal for the gospel clarification about the person, the work of Jesus, and things that you would expect. But one thing that you do have to note in terms of Edwards' biography is that he is so well read, right? So he, in his circle, there's certainly laughable literature that's emerging in his milieu. So after William and Mary, the Glorious Revolution, there's kind of a print explosion, right? And there comes on the scene some satirical writers. What comes to mind is someone like Jonathan Swift and his Modest Proposal, which is not modest, but quite funny. That would have landed right at the same time. And so in London, it would have been published in like 1729 when Edwards is beginning to take the helm in Northampton. And we have, I think volume 26 of the works of Jonathan Edwards highlights his catalog really well. And we know kind of Edwards's reading diet, if you will. So he would have had access to the periodicals of Joseph Addison and Richard Steele, the Whiggish Journal, The Guardian, other kinds of publications. So Edwards certainly has access to things that are humorous, the kind of satire that's emerging in his day. He lent out a copy of a known piece of literature, Pamela, at that time. So Edwards' well versedness in other areas that are not overtly theological do kind of color in for us that he certainly would have been aware of other parish ministers. If they were cracking jokes in the pulpit, he would have been aware of the same kind of source material that was coming through their newspapers.
Yeah. So speaking of the pulpit, this podcast has a wide audience of Edwards scholars, but also students and pastors. After all, we are Gateway Seminary. So we like to think through ministry implications on this podcast. Mm-hmm. In your opinion, what does Edwards' understanding of laughter have to offer to the church?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, whether Edwards loved to laugh is not quite clear, for he certainly suggests some reservations in particular contexts, but he undoubtedly surrounds himself with people who enjoyed such expression at different points in his life. So in terms of how this affects the pulpit and ministry, one, I think we have to look at the first kind of things that we talked about in our conversation about Edwards' just diehard love for the biblical text. I mean, he's drawing out, we can't really maybe model our own hermeneutics after his model. He gets to some pretty quirky and innovative places, no doubt. But the fact that Edwards just fixates on the biblical text and does clearly study it in depths and uses all the tools that he has available in his time, they show us just the place of scripture in the life of the church. And I think that's something that the church today doesn't need to forget. Whether you're a pastor or a lay person, the centrality, the kind of biblicism that marks evangelicals is there for a reason. But Edwards himself, I mean, you cut him anywhere, right? And he bleeds bibline pretty much. So there's a lot of areas where we can read Edwards helpfully and some not so much. But in terms of the other kinds of things that I looked in this particular paper, where I looked at Edwards' correspondence with his friends, there's one really helpful. And if anyone asks, like, what's the most helpful kind of devotional work of Edwards that's benefited me the most, what stands out to me is his advice to young converts, which is there's a nearby parish that doesn't have a minister. And Edwards comes in one day and he pens a 19-paragraph letter to this young girl who asked for spiritual advice. And within that, he talks about not treating religion with an air of lightness and laughter, right? He says, take the things of God seriously. And so it just shows how, especially in ministry, in relationships, where study is important, and if you're somebody who likes me, who likes to study and likes to do research, the necessity of relationships and opening up just your life, right? I think that that's a very overlooked fact that people came to Edwards's study where he might have been locked away for a long time, delving into the depths of the text. But just as he took time to care for people, like this young girl in a nearby parish that didn't have a pastor, and she was wondering, what do we do without a pastor? We're seeing evidences of God's grace in our time, and I want to grow in my faith. Seeing those kinds of areas in our own ministries and own lives where we can offer up what God is showing us in Scripture, and offer up insights from even detailed areas of study, to where we can really make that palpable and applicable to people, to stir people's joy for God, I think is pretty Edwardsian and something that I hope to emulate my own life as well. We often get the picture with Edwards, it's so eclipsed because we see him as a Reformed theologian or we see him as a philosopher, but there's a very human side to Edwards, and I think that that has application for life and for ministry.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a lot of great things there that we definitely would want to emulate. But as you've been studying him, have you come across any like points of tensions or concepts where he just misses the mark? I know we could just talk about that in general, but specifically either his like exegetical methods or something about laughter, because obviously you want to treat people in the past charitably, but not uncritically. Does he just miss the mark somewhere with his exegesis, whether of laughter or the way he approaches it or exegesis in general?
Yeah, so I mean, I think there's lots. To be brief, though, I mean, we don't ever want to be guilty of what C.S. Lewis calls a chronological snobbery. That's what comes to mind, right? I don't want to look back and think, God, Edwards is just terrible because how did he not understand, you know, this part of Second Temple Judaism? It's clear, right? Or this notion of biblical theology. Like that's things that land in our time that might not land in his. And that's okay. We need to practice some theological humility in the way that we learn from other individuals in the past. But especially in his exegesis, I think the difficulty and part of why there's so much work going on in this area of Edwards is that he's kind of hard to get a hold of in terms of what is his actual approach to the text, because there's some different moves, right? So there's lots of different moves exegetically, which on the one hand means that there's some good work that can be done kind of tracing those moves. But on the other hand, it's difficult to emulate that. It's difficult to find something that's really replicable. So I don't think that most evangelicals today would be as strong, like in that note on Scripture on Genesis 18. I don't think many evangelicals today would insist that the Pope is Antichrist, and that's kind of where Edwards lands. And that ties into some of his context, but also the commentary he's reading. In the paper, I traced out where Edwards relies a lot on a biblical commentator named Matthew Poole. And so for his New Testament stuff, especially, Matthew Poole becomes very important. Another person who lives in a Northampton, but in Britain, named Philip Doddridge, is also an important New Testament exegete for Edwards. So Edwards is drawing on kind of the best commentaries in his day. He's drawing on the D.A. Carsons and the G.K. Bills of his day, or whatever you want to say. Insert your favorite commentary here, right? He's drawing on that, but then he's often using those conclusions in novel ways. Those novel ways certainly get dated, especially as biblical studies and theological studies move forward in time. I don't get where Edwards gets eschatologically, and so that would be a clear area of difference between he and I.
Yeah, and in terms of lists of exegetes that he's looking at for the Baptists in the audience, he is familiar with Gill's work. Gill obviously is known for his commentary writing. So it shows up in the catalog, in his catalog of the books that he has owned and read.
Yeah, he also quotes Gill in The Religious Affections as well. One of Gill's works appears in The Religious Affections in a footnote too. So he's familiar with a lot of Reformed divines, and then he's familiar with a lot of non-Reformed divines as well in his time.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well read. So besides your own work, which hopefully we can see soon, are there other places where students might go to look at Edwards and his exegetical methods?
Yes, I would certainly
any like
put,
classic texts that like if you're going to study Edwards and his exegesis, like you got to go read this person.
Yes, I would certainly point people to the book Edwards the Exegete by Doug Sweeney, who's now the dean of Beeson Divinity School. Edwards the Exegete is a great book. It's got four case studies in it that kind of trace these kind of moves. There's another work that might be a little more topical. And so this was the first work that I read that led me to want to work on Jonathan Edwards and his exegetical method of John, because there was one chapter in a book called Jonathan Edwards and Scripture, by edited by Doug Sweeney and Dave Barshinger. And I hope I'm saying Dave Barshinger's name right. But JE and Scripture would be a great place to go, because if you want to know what Jonathan Edwards thought about Jonah and the great fish, and if you want to know what Edwards thought about a variety of topics by experts there, that's a great jumping off point. That's a bit more, that's a bit less technical than some of the other things. There's others, other works out there as well. There's a ton of dissertations. Well, I say a ton. There's a handful of dissertations that are being produced that at least I know of. I'm sure there's more. One on Edwards and Hebrews, one on Edwards and the Fourfold Gospel. I've seen one recently from Southeastern on Edwards and on the topic of wisdom, and Edwards on Old Testament wisdom literature. Lots of good things being put out there by the different Jonathan Edwards centers. And then when those things are produced, all of the Jonathan Edwards centers benefit, right? Because we all can share that work and those different dissertations and theses that are produced.
Yeah, it really does seem like this is the next trend, at least from my seat in Edwardsian scholarship, Edwards yeah. Exegete. Well, Zach, thank you for spending time with us. One last question. What's next for you in the world of Edwards, and where can our audience keep up with you if they want to do so?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Chris, and it's nice to talk to another Reformed Baptist about Edwards. It's kind of funny to study at an Anglican school, a dead Presbyterian or Congregationalist, depend upon who you ask, right? Different kind of moves in Edwards' thought and life. But yes, I have a forthcoming work put out by the good people at the JE Society. There's some interesting technology by a Edwards scholar named Rob Boss out there, but he also has edited a couple of volumes of Miscellanies Companions. So Edwards has more than 1,000 miscellanies, and sometimes they're hard to navigate, especially if you're new to Edwards. But the first two volumes have been published, and I will have an article there that will appear in volume 3 of the Miscellanies Companion. I'm tracing Edwards's language of fountain and four particular divines that he uses to come up with this language of fountain in his various miscellanies. Besides that, other places you can track with my works. Eventually will be said dissertation that we've discussed here. And of course, you can follow me on Twitter at Zach Tharp 12, which I guess it's now X, right? So yeah. You can follow me on X.
Yeah, I guess there were 11 other Zachs before you. Or was it like a number that you really like? You're like 12th disciple or something. Number 12, football jersey, I don't know.
No, but it's way lamer than that. It's way lamer than that. It's probably the year I got on Twitter, which was like my senior year of high school. So to bear my green around the gills-ness there. So it's 2012, or you know, tweets for the end of the world, whatever you want to say.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of email addresses that I'm sure as adults people are regretting that they made when they were in high school. You know, silly stuff. Anyway, well, thanks, yeah. Zach. I really appreciate it. Thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris. It's been a joy to chat.